don't need to do too much. So the whole concept of exceptions is built into Java as a language construct, and it has to deal with runtime errors. So any Java method that can cause a runtime error, well, almost any, I'll explain that a little bit later, will have as part of its interface in the declaration of the method something called a throw, which gives the name of the exception that can be caused during that method. Then other methods which may use that either must catch the exception, which is to say what to do in the event of the exception, or it can refuse to handle the exception, and it can itself throw the exception to someone who calls it. So here is the basic structure of exception handling. Oh, excuse me. Next time that happens that I forget to switch monitors, would someone please point it out? I'm sorry. You were wondering where I was, right? Okay, I was going over the first page on exceptions. This is at the end of talk two. So here's the basic structure of exceptions. Notice that down at the bottom is defined a method called method 3, which is could possibly cause a runtime error, like dividing by zero or reading a file, which can cause a runtime error if the file isn't there or if the permissions are wrong for what you're trying to do or something like that. So this method in its declaration will have the keyword throws and will give the name of the exception that it's going to possibly give at runtime. Now, in the middle of the page is an example of a method here called method 2, which can calls a method, method 3, which can cause a runtime error, but it doesn't want to handle the exception, so it itself just passes the exception on through to whoever calls it. At the top here, we have a method which is calling method 2, and which intends to handle this exception. So the call to method 2 is put inside this try statement. The first part, the first block of the try statement is one or more statements which may include calls to methods which may give runtime errors. It could be more than one call. You could have a number. You could have a whole block of code there. You don't have to handle tiny individual exceptions. You could handle a whole block of code that might cause one or more exceptions. Anyway, at the end of the try block, there's the keyword catch, and then inside the parentheses, you give a variable name, in this case E, and then you give the name as a type, you give the name of the exception that you're going to handle. Then there's another block and you have some code which handles the error. Or you can have an empty block if it's an error that you don't care about. And I mean, you can handle it by doing nothing. Now there's a hierarchy of exception names built into Java. The Java classes that are already there can give various types of exceptions. And so everything is a throwable exception. The ones that you have to catch are actually called exceptions. And then under that, here at the level of array exception, there's a whole list of types of exceptions that can occur. And in general, they're grouped together like array exception, so that you don't have to try to catch individual array exceptions, but you can just catch the whole class of them in any method which might cause array exceptions. Here's an example that shows how to catch an I/O exception for doing file I/O. So in this example, in the statement try, there is some calls to various methods doing files. Here's a file created. You say new file, and it creates a handle to the file with name that you want. And then, for example, a method that you can do on that file is the write method. You presumably needed to open the file first, and so there could be any number of statements here. Then you can catch all I/O errors from opening the file, from doing various read and writes, by catching something of type I/O exception. And then you have to put some kind of handling in this block. You might want to print some sort of error message to the user saying, you know, I couldn't find this file, or this file had the wrong permission. And there are other methods to handle that. And then at the end, you can optionally put the keyword finally and have another block which has a set of code which is always to be executed whether or not the code terminates normally. So you can make sure there's something that happens. And in this case, the thing that you might want to make sure happens is that the file gets closed, regardless of whether there was an error. So all the things that I was showing you were a subclass of the class throwable that is called exception, and it's a subclass of exceptions, runtime exceptions, which you don't have to necessarily catch. And examples of these are things like out-of-memory errors. There are some types of errors which could sort of happen anywhere and are so disastrous that they don't make you catch them. So that there are things that, runtime errors that can occur that you don't have to catch in your code. So those were general remarks about exceptions, and they're true whether you're writing a Java application or a Java applet. But the only thing different about Java applets, unlike applications, where if you're writing a method and you might choose to pass the exception on up to somebody, in an applet you can't really choose to do that because you're being called by the browser, and the browser is not prepared to handle exceptions. So you really must handle all the exceptions that could happen. If you really want to bring an error to the attention of the viewer, such as they typed in their URL incorrectly or so on, you can give messages. But if you don't want to go to a lot of programming to present messages on the browser window to the user, in fact, if you have a runtime error, if the applet suddenly quits, the user should look under the Java console, under the options menu, and it will display the runtime errors that occurred. So there are ways of getting this kind of information from the browser window. And I think that's the last page of that talk. Is that right? Oh. It dropped off the end of the world. Well, that was supposed to be the last page. I guess it got lost in the copying process. I'm going to start the third talk, which is in general about graphics and about the abstract windowing toolkit. And I think in this initial part of this class, that's about as far as we're going to get. I may touch briefly on a couple of topics in the fourth section, but not too much. And in fact, we may be able later in the course to come back to some of those issues or handle them as they arise. So actually, in order to tell you more about graphics, you may have noticed, as you recall from last time when I introduced the example about wanting to have a moving object in the browser window, I had to introduce a thread that would say what the computation was that was going to move the object. So I want to give a short introduction to threads here without getting deeply into issues about programming multi-threading. So what is a thread? Well, essentially, you just think of a thread as a sequential flow of control. It's a list of statements that says to do something. And that's sort of a general definition. If a process or what you might think of as a program has more than one thread, then they execute what is known as concurrently. That is, each sequential flow of control is interleaved by the CPU so that each one gets a chance to run. And it appears to you like they're both running at the same time. There's only one CPU that's actually running them, but since it's running each one a little bit in turn, it looks like they're both making progress. So that's why you want to introduce threads, is when you want to have more than one flow of control that's making progress, so that you don't just have one flow of control execute continuously and finish before you get to start the other one. They both get to run, get a chance to run at the same time. So in applets, you do want to do that, because if you're going to have something that's running continuously in the browser window, you want it to have a separate flow of control as the browser. So there'll be two, essentially, flows of control. One will be the browser window, which is doing things like detecting if the user tries to close the window or move a window around in the screen. And your applet flow of control, which is actually doing things in the interesting things in the browser window. Now in Java, when you introduce an extra thread, the main part of the computation is always supposed to be in a method called run. So the way that you have an independent flow of control is that you create something called a thread, and you give it a method called run, which has the computation that you want to do. That's one way to do it. And in general, there are times with applets where you want to, you can create separate classes, which is create threads in that way. But if you want to introduce a thread under the control of the applet, you have this problem that you can't have the applet be a thread itself, because it's already an applet. But it can't be a child of two different parents. So that's why this interface mechanism is introduced. And I'm going to show you how that works. I guess first I'll show you the way the code looks to remind you, and then I want to go to the Java resource page and show you more about how to look up methods with applets. In particular, we'll look up the thread class and see what kind of methods it has. So if you want your applet to have a thread with a flow of control, you add the keyword implements runnable to the header of the applet so that you have the interface for threads. You include an instance variable for the thread so that you create a new thread. And you have a run method, which has the body of the code that you want to run. And you have a start and stop method, which can start and stop the thread from running. And before I go through the code from the example, let's check out a little bit more about the thread class. So here I am. I can go to the Java resources, which is this little coffee cup icon. And in here, we have not only the lectures that I, online versions of these lectures that I'm giving now, but some examples and tutorials, which I'm going to go over more at the end of class, because I want to show you where to find some examples that will be helpful in writing your homework. But we copied down a local copy of the Java, some of the Java documentation. And this is a new version, which actually I don't find quite as helpful as some of the old versions. And we just copied it down because it'll be faster for you to connect than to connect to the original version at Sun. So the packages, so here is a list of all the Java packages, and it describes what classes are in each one. And if you look under java.lang, it says that it has essential Java classes, including a list of number of things, and that list includes threads. So we'll click on this, and here are the list of classes. And sure enough, it includes thread. And here's the list of interfaces. So first, let's check out the interface runnable, which is the one that we're using. And the interface for runnable is very simple. It says that if you're going to implement runnable, you have to have a method called run. That's all that says. There's no body to the method run. This is abstract. It's just a promise to the compiler that if I say that I'm going to implement runnable, I will have there a method called run. And that means that some other packet, some other class, can know that I implement runnable and can call my run method. It's guaranteed that there will be a run method there. So let's look at the thread class. I don't find this formatting of the Java API quite as nice as the old version. Maybe I just haven't found the right version yet since we recopied everything. But anyway, here is the API for the thread class. And it is a subclass of object, and it also implements the interface runnable. It has some fields, some variables having to deal with being able to have a whole group of threads and setting priorities. And I'm not going to get into details of that. I just want to show you some of the things that are here. And there are some number of constructors here. And really, the two main constructors are the first two. And I will tell you what's important about those two constructors. If you create a class, which is a subclass of thread, you use this first constructor to create the thread. If you have a class like an applet, which implements runnable and wants to create a thread, you use this constructor to create the thread. And what this constructor does, you give this constructor the reference to the applet, and this constructor says, create a thread, but its run method will be the run method given by this reference. So you write your applet, it has a run method. When you use this constructor to create the thread, it does it using the run method of the applet. And that's how it all hooks together, having an interface space and being able to create a thread. In this API, there are not a lot of explanations. I will, when I have more time, I'll look around in some of the documentation and see if I can find a slightly better version. There are lots of other methods here having to do with fairly complex things that you might want to do with threads. But in particular, all we want to do is to be able to start and stop the thread. So there are methods. Anybody who creates a thread, the thread is going to execute the run method. And if it has a loop, it could execute it, you know, running on forever. But you can always start and stop it by issuing these commands, these methods on the thread. Let me show you the example. Here's an example which is a very simple animation, and I'm going to ask you to do for your homework an example which is also an animation. So this is an example of a simple form of the kind of thing you want to do. And this one is essentially a digital clock. It's going to have a loop which keeps looking up the date and displaying it. So it'll just continuously display an updated clock face. So we call it digital clock. Of course, it's an applet, so it has to be a subclass of applet. And it's going to implement runnable because it has to have this continuously running thread. Here we declare and create a font that we're going to use to print the results of the time. We have a date, so we have a variable that's declared to be of type date, and we have a variable that's declared to be of type thread. So these are the instance variables of this class. Now here are two methods that the applet wants to include. An applet can always have a start and stop method that it's going to execute whenever the applet is started and stopped. Now, when is an applet started and stopped? Whenever any, it varies a little bit according to the browser, but almost all browsers, if the applet is running in the browser window and someone closes the browser, and even in some browsers, if they take another frame and put it on top, then the applet will actually stop. Then when they reopen the browser window or take another frame off of it, the applet will restart. So in order to save system resources, let me back up a minute. When the applet is started and stopped, the thread that the applet created is still running over here someplace. So what we do is, when the applet is started and stopped, we make it start and stop the thread as well. So when the applet is started, if this tests to see if the runner is already created or not, and in this case, if the runner is not created and the applet starts, we want to create the thread. So here's where we say runner equals new thread, and this is the constructor I showed you where you want to give a reference to this applet so this run method will be used. And the way you give a reference to yourself is there's a special keyword called this. Okay, so I'm using the keyword this as an argument to the thread constructor. So now the thread that's constructed will have a reference to this applet, and it can use it to say this applet.run, and it can run the run method that's over here in the applet. So once we've created the thread, then we use the start method of the thread to make it start. So now the applet is running, and the thread that it created is running. And the applet is running under control of the browser. If for any reason the applet is stopped, in order to save resources, if the runner is defined, that is, if it's not a null pointer, we stop that thread and we set it to be null. So anytime the applet stops, we make the runner stop. So when you write an applet method that's going to have a loop like this with an animation, if you call your thread runner, then you can include this start and stop method just the way it is, and it will all work fine. Or if you change the name of the thread, just change the equivalent thing in here. So here's the main point, which is that there's supposed to be a method called run, which says what to do. And this method has an infinite loop while true. The body of the loop is going to put up the date, and then it's going to wait a while before it goes around and does it again, because otherwise the clock will run so fast nobody can read it. So it creates the current date into this variable, this date variable called the date, by calling the date constructor with no arguments. So that gets the current date, including hours, minutes, and seconds. And in order to show that on the browser window, we call repaint. And repaint calls update, which calls paint. And I'm going to go over those more in a minute. So essentially, this repaint will call this paint method down here. It sets the font to be whatever we want, and it draws a string that has the date in it. Now, almost every class is provided with a standard method called toString, which converts the data represented by that class to a string for viewing. This is a standard thing that people do when they define classes representing dates. So So this variable the date has type date, and we can't print that or do a drawstring on that. But we can convert it to a string by calling the method toString, and then we can call drawstring. And this, as you may recall, is part of the drawstring. It's in the graphics package, and you tell it which pixel location to start drawing the string that you're trying to draw. So back up to our loop. So first we put up the date, and then we want to wait a second in between every time the date is updated. So there's another thread method called sleep, which we can call and tell it to sleep for 1,000 milliseconds. Sleep is a method that has an exception, so we put it inside the try, and then we have a catch. And the thing that can happen, the runtime exception that can happen to sleep, is that you get interrupted execution, and in our case, we don't care. If the thread has interrupted execution while it's trying to sleep, all that will happen is that it sleeps longer than we thought, and that's okay. So we do nothing in this block over here to handle the exception. Yes? This has come up before, and this works, but theoretically this should be runner.sleep, and I should change the size because it makes more sense. I forgot about that. I would have changed the slide. Yes. Well, that really should be runner.sleep. It's the only way it makes sense. I consider it an anomaly that that works. So just consider that a typo and change that word thread where it says thread.sleep to runner.sleep. What page is this? Thank you. Are there any other questions about this example? Okay. Just waiting for the network here. Normally it's pretty good. This is very odd. There we go. Now I want to go over in some more detail about repaint and update and so on. I've mentioned that several times. So we've done applications in which we have an applet which in the browser window wants to change what is drawn there. And whenever you want to redraw the string, you're supposed to call repaint. Now repaint has no arguments, and what repaint does is it gets the graphics contents of the current browser window, and the graphics context tells it what is the current color, what is the current font, and all that stuff. And it creates a thread. It calls update. And the update calls your paint function. So before update calls the paint function, though, the default update has code which first blanks out the background with whatever the background color is supposed to be to erase or to cover up whatever was already drawn there. Otherwise, whenever you keep drawing things to the graphics window, it just piles them up on top. And if you want to make several calls to graphics methods to create a whole window full of stuff, that's exactly what you want. But when you want to totally change the scene, then update will blank out what's there, and then call your paint method to paint on the new scene. Is this next slide about update? I'm trying to talk about the slide without knowing what anything, what's on there. Well, the next slide is not about update. So actually, I want to go quickly over the next two slides. We already showed some about creating fonts and creating new colors, and there's some more detail about that on these slides, but I think I can leave that to you to read if you want to do more about fonts and colors. And in fact, not everything is listed here, so that you need to go and check the Java resources or one of your books if you want to get, for example, the complete list of colors and so on. But one of the things I haven't mentioned yet about fonts is that there is a lot of each font has properties called font metrics. And you can say get font metrics and get some of those properties, like how tall the characters are, what is the leading, what is the kerning. There's lots of sort of printer's properties of various fonts so that you can figure out, if you care to, exactly how that font is going to fill the browser window. Because as you know, if you put up a string in different fonts, it's going to take up different amounts of space depending on the characteristics of the font. And all that is handled in the font metrics. So we don't seem to have gotten that picture up. On page 12 is listed the basic methods for applets that I think we've already pretty much discussed. It has the start and stop methods, which are executed every time that there's some interruption to the browser window. There's init, which is executed only once when the applet is downloaded. And what else is on that list? Paint for actually showing something on the window. Okay, so on page 13 is actually listed these other ones: paint, repaint, and update. All of these have defaults which are given in the applet class itself, but whenever you want different behavior for one of these methods in your applet, you just override it by giving your own method. And you've already been doing that with paint, because every time you want to define exactly what you want to paint, you give your own paint method. I'm also going to skip this. In your notes, you have a Sun animation applet, which is quite an applet that's already provided for you to do animations involving sequencing through a set of images in order to make appearance of motion. So if you provide the set of images, you can just run this standard applet from Sun, and it will do the animation for you. It also allows you to provide a sequence of sounds that goes with the set of images. You can have an initial sound, so it's quite complex. So I'm going to skip down to page 18, which talks about images and double buffering. So we talked about some of the methods in the graphics package which allow you to draw simple shapes on the browser window, but you also need to know how to be able to draw a picture that's already been provided, and to, you know, an image, and to actually have that drawn on the browser window. And there are built-in methods to do that. It assumes that the image is going to come from a URL someplace. So there's a couple of ways to specify what the URL is where you want to get the image downloaded from. And the first is that there is actually a class called URL in Java, and you can give it as a quoted string the URL that you want as an argument to this constructor. And this will construct a representation of the URL as a Java class. And what the constructor does, actually this is just a code snippet. Normally you would, this constructor is, will possibly have a runtime error. It will possibly throw an exception, which is that it checks and makes sure that what you gave it was a well-formed URL. And it has an exception called, I believe, malformed URL, which it will give if that's not true. So you need to actually do all this inside a try block. But anyway, this is only one of the places where you want to be able to use URLs in general, because you can get down images or documents or other things from the web server. So this is the main method called getImage. And you give it a URL and it will start the start downloading the image. There are other forms of getImage in which you, instead of giving the complete URL, including the name of the image document, is that first you give the part of the URL which specifies one of two directories. And one of the directories that is possible to specify is the web directory where your Java code resided, the Java applet, as part of the web directory. And that's a special method called getDocumentBase. Well, get the URL, the part of the URL that points to wherever the applet was loaded from. And then in addition to that, you give a path name from that directory of where the image resides. So if you had a directory called images and it was in there, you would give, in quotes, images/image.gif. Alternatively, you can have, I said this backwards. This is get document based. This is the part of the URL where the web page that called the applet resides. This is where the HTML resides. And it's possible that your applet also resides there, but you could have put your applet someplace else, and that's get code based. So that's the other form. You could have put the image over there. I started to say that backwards. So getImage just starts the download process. What actually displays the image on the browser screen is part of the graphics class. It has a method called drawImage. If you give it something of type image, which could have been downloaded, and give it the top left-hand corner where you want to load that, you can also give it a width and height. And then you must give a reference to something which is it can pass to the image observer, and a reference to yourself is okay in most cases. And I'll explain about the image observer in just a minute. So getImage only starts the download process. If the network is slow, when you call drawImage, it may be that not all of the image has been downloaded yet. And drawImage will go ahead and try to draw as much of the image that is already available. But it will only draw that part. So there are other methods that allow you to control this process. And these are, I'm not going to give the details here, but you can look up in the Image Observer class or the Media Tracker class. And there are methods which you can interrogate and see if the image is completely downloaded yet. and you can wait and see if the download has occurred before you try to do draw image on the screen. And we have some examples of that in our example, in our Java example collection as well. This is a very simple image drawing example, just showing the call to get image in init, and then later a call to draw image with that image. Actually, it gets the width and height of the image. There's methods that you can do on images called get width and get height, and makes it 1/4 smaller than it used to be. Is there a question over here? I thought I saw him. Now, sometimes when you define an applet where you are keep changing the what is being drawn on the screen, you get what's called flickering. That is, you kind of get that, flickering on the image. And the reason is that normally when you're drawing the applet, first you call paint, and then, you call repaint every time you want to repaint the applet. It calls update, which blanks out what used to be there, and then calls paint to calculate what to draw on the screen. Now, if paint is really simple, there won't be any flickering. But paint can actually sometimes be quite complex, as it calculates what to draw on the screen. And if this takes any amount of time, then you'll get flickering because there's a considerable amount of time between when update blanked out the old image and when the new image appears, or graphics image. So you get flickering. So there are various ways to solve this problem and the first kind of way has to do with if you know like exactly what part of the drawing area is being changed, you don't have to blank out everything. You only have to blank out the part that's going to change. But that's a specific thing that you would program in. There's a more general solution to preventing flickering, and that's called double buffering. Here's the actual default update method. I told you it blanked out the background. Here's the code that does that. It gets the background color, fills in the rectangle, gets the foreground color, and goes on. So to do double buffering, what you do is instead of drawing directly or calculating your drawing and doing it directly on the graphics object that is represented by the browser window, you create another graphics object, what you might call a frame buffer, or another image, which is going to be off in memory someplace. You calculate what you want to draw there, and then at the last minute you transfer what you want to draw to the actual browser window. And that's so that you have two, essentially, graphics buffers, one which is the browser window and one which is off in memory someplace that you can do calculations in. So in your init method, you would create this extra buffer. And what you do is you create something of type image. Here the variable is called off-screen image. You declare something of type graphics. Here it's called off-screen graphics. And so this is the second image in graphics context. The first is created by the browser, and you never have to worry about creating it, the first image in graphics context. Then somewhere, possibly in init, possibly elsewhere, like in start, you would actually do the create the image and get the graphics of that image. Now, in your applet, everywhere that you had, essentially, primarily in your paint method, everywhere you were using some graphics method before to draw directly to the browser window, instead of drawing to the browser window, which usually we called that G, the graphics context G, you would be drawing rectangles, circles, in this case draw image, to instead of G, to the off-screen graphics context that you created in the frame buffer. So all your graphics methods would be done on that graphics object. Finally, at the end of paint, you would transfer this image, which was this off-screen graphics, was the graphics context of something called a variable called off-screen image, and you would use draw image on the real graphics context G of the browser window with the image that you created offline, off-screen image. So that draws it to the browser window at the very end. And finally, you would provide your own update method that didn't bother to blank out the background, because it's just going to calculate the whole thing and then transfer it over. This shows what I just described to you in an actual example, and so you can read that if you want to look at more details. I want to show you another capability of applets in the browser window. So far, everything that we've done has been pretty much related to using the graphics package just to draw things like rectangles and circles, strings, or images. One of the things that Java is good for in providing user interaction in the browser is that it has a whole series of events that are able, that is, it's able to control the mouse at the local level. And how it does that is through a programming technique called event handling. So this is a tutorial that you can read. I'm going to skip all that and go directly to the example. Now, all the time that you're running a Java applet, it's actually set up for mouse interaction. That is, no matter what Java applet you run, while you have the mouse in the applet window, there's a sequence of events being reported to the browser window, and it reports that to the applet in something called the event handler. And so right now, every time I move the mouse, I'm getting an event reported to the applet. And that's true in any applet window. But in this particular applet, so the default event handler of the applet is to ignore motion of the mouse. But you can override those event handlers, provide your own that does something useful that the user will like when they move the mouse. So here, if I move the mouse, I've programmed this so that if you move the mouse so that it's inside one of these objects, it changes the color, right? Or actually, Michael Chang did. I didn't program this. So if you move it into any object, it just changes the color. And so those are mouse move events. It also detects if you hold down the mouse button. So if you're inside an object and you hold down the mouse, so I've clicked down the mouse. I know you can't see that on the screen. Then I can, as I move the mouse, I can drag this object. And then when I let up on the mouse button, it'll stay where it is. So I have to provide the programming that says if the user holds down the mouse button, what to do. So in this particular example, what I'm doing is changing the color of these objects, and I'm allowing them to move. So I'm going to use those classes we had before that had movable rectangles and circles and triangles, but this time, instead of having a loop that automatically makes them move in a particular way, I'm going to have an event handler that says wherever the user moves the mouse, that's where to make that object move. All right? And notice if you move the mouse fast that it doesn't try to do every little move. It just records where you are and jumps there. Okay? So there are a whole class of events and handling in Java, but the business about being able to use the mouse is so common that they gave special names to those events, and so you can give separate event handlers for each of those events. And we'll talk a lot more about event handling when we get to the part of the windowing system that has buttons and frames and things where you have more events happening. Actually, you can handle events from particular keys that are pushed on the keyboard, and those have names like the F1 key or the up arrow. And there are special event names for all the mouse motions. So there's mouse down, mouse drag, mouse enter. When you change the focus, if you move the mouse outside the window, when you come back in, that's mouse enter, and so on. Mouse move, key up and key down for the keyboard. There are various other things. So you can have something happen in your applet window just because the user moved the mouse out of the window when they move it back in. And I'm going to go over this example because you might want to do some mouse programming. And I actually, though, want to tell you that I think this is part of the Java classes which is significantly expanded in the next version of the Java Development Kit. So here you have to sort of program mouse dragging yourself. And in JDK 1.1, which is out but is still so buggy that we didn't want to use it for the class, there is actually a more sort of a high level, more abstract version of doing mouse dragging. So this will get easier, I think, in the future, but for now I feel like I kind of have to tell you this way to do it because that's the only way that really works for now. So this is the code for this thing. It does have double buffering, so this variable called img is the image that's going to be have the graphics context for the double buffering. There are three objects. I have my object array the way I did before. It's going to have the, in this case, it's going to have the square, the circle, and the triangle. Then I have four variables that I introduce into this class, which are essentially going to hold the state of what's happening with the mouse. And the first variable, well, let me talk about hit first. Hit is going to be minus one if the user is not holding the mouse over any object. It's going to have the number of the object in the array if the user moves the mouse over an object. Current will be the number of the object if you're dragging it. And X offset and Y offset are going to be the relative position of the mouse with respect to the upper left-hand corner of the object while you're dragging. And let me show you why you want to do that. Because when the user is going to drag this object, they can put the mouse down anywhere. And so you need to remember how far away from the upper left-hand corner it is. So when you move the mouse a little bit, you know, I never know how to explain this, how to make the object move smoothly. You have to know where to put the upper left-hand corner of the object as you're dragging it around. Because the user could click anywhere. Okay? And what you get reported from the event is where the mouse is, not where the object is. So as the user clicks there, then you record how far away it is from the upper left-hand corner so that you know when you're dragging around to new mouse location where the new upper left-hand corner location is going to be. There's the init function for the applet, and it's going to give the initial position that has the three objects all colored red. So it creates this array with three things. In the zero location, it calls the constructor for rectangle. In the one location, it creates a circle. And in the two location, it creates a triangle, and they're all red. Here's also where we call the create image of the width and height of the browser window that creates the actual off-screen buffer, IMG. Now, actually, Michael did the paint and update backwards from the way I would do it. But this works as well. He has paint call update instead of vice versa. So this is going to go through and paint the three objects. Here's where you can do the get graphics in init if you want and just do it once. But Michael chose, in this case, every time you call the paint function, he does the get graphics of the off-screen buffer. And then down here, he does this dispose, which gets rid of it. One of the things that happens when you do get graphics is a lot of memory is allocated to hold all the pixels of the off-screen buffer. And so he wanted to have that memory allocated here and to get rid of it down here. And that's a choice he made. If you don't feel like you're using too much memory in your program, then you probably don't care, and you would just do get graphics in the init method and not worry about this. Just do it once and not worry about dispose. Anyway, so we draw the background on the, so our off-screen graphics object is called OG, so everything we draw on OG. And that's all the background stuff. Here's the loop that draws the object. We use the paint method that belongs to each object, and we paint it to OG. And the very last thing we do is transfer the image to draw image. Notice that dispose disposes of all the graphics context part, but not of the actual off-screen image, which is still there, and you can still draw it onto the screen in the current graphics context G. This gets into a lot of details about the paint programming. Okay, so the rest of it, so that's what initially paints the screen, and it's going to repaint the screen when the objects are moved. And the rest of this is event programming. And this is kind of a different flavor of programming than you may be used to if you're used to a procedure-oriented programming or object-oriented programming, where you're always in control and you say what's supposed to happen next. In event handling programming, your program just sort of sits back and waits. And the way you program things that happen is that if the user does something, then you respond. So this program is now going to sit around and wait. And if the user moves the mouse, an interrupt will be generated that is sent to one of my methods that is supposed to handle these events. So the first one is, if the user moves the mouse, I get a mouse move event. So I have to program this method called mouse move that says what to do in case the user moves the mouse. So every time the user moves the mouse, even a little bit, what I get is a new pixel location, X and Y. And that's reported, so the name of the event, which in this case I don't really need, but in general, in your event handler, you may be handling lots of different events. I mean, there's only one mouse, but later we're going to get on to handling events for buttons and choice boxes, and you might have any number of buttons on the page, and you would have to be able to tell which button generated the event. Then there, in the case of the mouse, you also get reported the new X and Y location in pixels of where the mouse is. So he programmed into the, added some methods to the movable rectangle class so that you could test and see if a pixel location that the mouse was at, X and Y, was actually inside the location of any particular object that you were at. So we can write a loop that goes through and tests if the new mouse location is inside any object. And the first time we find that's true, then we break out of the loop and go through this loop, which is going to change the color, the color associated with each object, if necessary. And it uses, so it does set color, and it tests to see if you have the index I of an object which has been hit. And this is this conditional expression. So if I equals hit is true, it will pick cyan as the color. Otherwise, it will pick red. Okay, so this loop goes for all objects. So all the objects which the mouse is not inside stay red. And if the mouse is inside one of them, then that color is changed to cyan. And then you repaint so that the new color shows up. All right? Now, mouse dragging has three events. Mouse down, where you click the mouse button. Mouse drag, where the mouse is moving while the button is held down. And mouse up, when you finally let up the button. And I guess I should go through some of these details. First of all, we record in the variable current if the mouse is actually inside, that is, if the hit variable is been set for the mouse being inside any object. Because if you click down on the mouse and you're not inside an object, nothing happens. We don't have to do anything. But if if the mouse is inside an object, we record the difference between the X location of the mouse and the upper left-hand X, the X location of the object, and same for Y in this X and Y offset. And that's all we do when the mouse goes down. Now, if the mouse is down and it moves, and if it was inside so that the current was set to be the number of the object which was moving, then we also introduce a new function called moveTo that moves the object, whichever it was, to the new location, which is the X and Y offset with respect to where it was. And we repaint. And finally, when the user lets up the mouse, we set current to be -1, and it's all over. Mouse dragging is over. So that's kind of programming it the hard way, although not as painfully as if you tried to program X windows or something like that. But compared to Visual Basic, this is a little more complicated way to program. Here's the definition of those other methods that we had to provide in the movable point class. Is inside, move to, which just changes, redefines the X and Y location. And here's the is inside that we put into mRectangle to test, just compares to see if it's inside the boundaries set by X and Y, the upper left-hand corner, and the width and height of the object. That's a simple calculation. You can also do keyboard events. You test, you can have key down or key up. You can test the name of the keyboard event and do something appropriate. I won't go into that in detail. So keyboard events, though, is the kind of thing you do to, it's like you were programming a game and you wanted something special to happen if somebody hit one key. If you want people to actually type in text, then there are better ways to handle that. You don't have to handle people typing in text one key at a time. And that's all part of the abstract windowing toolkit, which is next. But before we get started on that, I want to be sure and have time to show you more of the examples on the class resource page that you can look at when you're for doing your homework.